The Theosophical Society presents Miss Joy Mills in a talk entitled The Nature of the Mystical Experience.
I was interested in a statement that has been made by Rainer Johnson, not in his books, but in a magazine article, an article which he wrote for the American Theosophist and which will ultimately appear, I think, in a book, because we are at present preparing another quest book which will be on this subject of mysticism. And in this article, Mr. Johnson has said, with regard to the mystical experience, this is the most important type of experience a human being can have, and it is the most difficult to talk about. So one could say with that, here is a significant experience, and here we are attempting to talk about something that is really inexpressible. When we begin to talk about the experience, we really run into all kinds of difficulties. Perhaps one of the most beautiful expressions of it, and indicating something of this difficulty, is the description of his experience, the mystical experience, by the great Sufi mystic Farid al-Din Attar. Whoever leaves this world behind him passes away from mortality, and when he has passed away from mortality, he attains to immortality. If thou dost desire to reach this abode of immortality and to attain this exalted state, which means this state of mysticism, divest thyself first of self, and then summon unto thyself a winged steed out of nothingness to bear thee aloft. Clothe thyself with the garment of nothingness, and drink the cup of annihilation. Cover thy breast with nothingness, and draw over thy head the robe of non-existence. Set thy foot in the stirrup of complete renunciation, and looking straight before thee, ride the steed of non-being to the place where nothing is. Here you see this tremendous experience that is all the time full of contradictories, paradox, as we said last week. Paradox, as I defined for you, as it has been defined, simply a truth standing on its head to gain attention. But all the time, this contradictory sort of statement that it is not. Now, last week I suggested that there are seven characteristics or seven marks of the mystical state of consciousness, what has been referred to as the mystical experience. And tonight I would like to elaborate on these in discussing the nature of the mystical experience. And then if we can, if you wish to discuss some of these, to try to probe it more deeply, again, I'd like to emphasize that while I, tonight, as in many of these meetings, will be drawing upon classical cases that have been recorded, I want to reiterate the statement I made last week, that at least in my estimation and in the estimation of many writers, the mystical experience is not an uncommon experience. I am absolutely convinced that everyone, really, at some time or another, has had an experience which can be described as mystical. Now, to jump ahead a little and to anticipate myself by anticipating also possible questions from you, next week I want to discuss with you a very important topic, mysticism and parapsychology, the parapsychological experience. Is there a relation? What is the difference? And so on. So we need to be very clear, first of all, as I hope we can be tonight, on this matter of what is the mystical experience. But if we can agree that there are these seven characteristics, then we can look at our own experiences, and any experience that participates in one of these characteristics or has about it a significant number of these marks, as it were, then we may suggest that we have had a mystical experience. First is this quality of ineffability. And perhaps this is very clear from the passage I've just read from the Sufi mystic Attar, Farid al-Din Attar. This quality of ineffability, that is, the experience itself defies expression, accurate description. Now, in one sense, from this point of view, almost every experience that we have has this quality of ineffability about it. If you have ever tried to describe to a person who has never tasted an apple what an apple tastes like, you will know that there is in that experience an ineffability, a quality of ineffability. Have you ever tried to describe blueness to a blind person? I remember on one occasion I was the guest in a home of one of our members who has been blind since infancy, a most remarkable person who is able to do a great number of things. And I was to give a lecture in that city that evening, and after I had finished dressing and so on, we were about to leave, this friend said to me, "What color is the dress that you are wearing tonight?" Now, it happened to be a rather electric shade of blue, at least what I think of as an electric blue. It was a vital blue. How do you describe that color? Any color, in fact. And so I suggested to her, how did she perceive colors? If I said blue, what did this seem to mean in her experience? And we came to coolness and various qualities from other experiences, from feel or taste, some other sensation, do you see? But the actual color of blueness is really indescribable, isn't it? How do you describe hotness to a person, you see? Any of these experiences. In other words, in every real experience that we have, there is a quality of ineffability. It is a state of feeling. It gives rise to a certain state of feeling. And deep mystical states almost always, in fact, always, I would say, participate in this characteristic of ineffability. Perhaps one of the most magnificent examples in all mystical literature is that of the French scientist, mathematician, philosopher Pascal, who, it is said, had a transforming experience as a very young man. But he never mentioned much about it, never said much about it, and when he died as quite an elderly man, there was found sewn into the hem of his doublet a piece of paper, and on that piece of paper was written this: from about 10:30 in the evening to about half an hour after midnight, fire, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not the God of philosophers and scholars, absolute certainty, beyond reason, joy, peace, forgetfulness of the world and everything but God. The world has not known thee, but I have known thee. Joy, 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 tears of joy. Here, obviously, was recorded a mystical experience that changed his entire life, and this struggle to find the words to convey that which defies description. So this, I would suggest, is the first quality to be looked for in the genuine mystical experience. The second, as I suggested last week, is what has been called a noetic quality. That is, it is a state of absolute knowing. There is an insight into the depths of truth that is not possible through the discursive intellect, an insight which carries the burden of authority that enables the person somehow to say, I know this. That it is an absolute presence. Perhaps again to quote a classic example, and I'm taking many of these examples from the classical mystical literature, although in many of the books, in Rainer Johnson's Imprisoned Splendor, which I understand a number of you did pick up at the bookstore last week, and it is available, of course, in the Quest edition, Rainer Johnson gives a number of experiences from people that are not generally thought, or whose names are really not known. They're not among what we might call the classical writers in mysticism. But the examples, by and large, that I'm quoting from tonight are from what are the classical examples, because perhaps they're the most marked. And this noetic quality of knowing is perhaps found most markedly in Dante, in the Paradiso section of the Divine Comedy, where he speaks of his experience in paradise, and in that depth saw in one volume clasped of love whate'er the universe unfolds, all properties of substance and of accident beheld compounded, yet one individual light the whole, and of such bond methinks I saw the universal form. And then he speaks of this vision and how little really remains of it, and this participates in another quality of the transiency of the experience. Yet in my inmost soul I know the sweet instilling which it did impart. This absolute, utter certainty that is present, that is there, I know. Whoso has felt the spirit of the highest is the way in which Myers describes St. Paul's experience, cannot confound, nor doubt him, nor deny. Yea, with one voice, O world, though thou deniest, stand thou on that side, for on this am I. This is that utter knowing that even if the whole world should deny this reality, and this is the kind of authority that is present in this noetic quality. So it is not only a state of feeling, but a state of knowing, of absolute knowing. The third characteristic may be called the quality of transiency. Now, essentially, there are two ways in which the mystic experience can be described or characterized as transient. First, almost everyone who writes about such an experience comments that it was like a flash, that it was a momentary sort of thing, that it lasted only a very brief period of time, that it, in fact, time, as will come, one of the other characteristics is a timelessness, but that it was not sustained over days or weeks or months, that it was a flash, taking a picture with a photo gun, as it were, that the flash is there, and then it is gone. And so what is described is the afterglow that remains, and that during this moment, the momentariness of it, as it has sometimes been called, the momentariness of it, during that, there was no awareness of I or it or you or anything else, but just of the light, the fire, whatever it was, the joy, the radiance, the peace, whatever that was. There is another aspect in which this quality of transiency is frequently referred to by some of the great mystics, and that is that it gives rise to a kind of reversal in the flow of consciousness. It is very interesting that in Jungian psychology, Dr. Carl Jung, for example, in his studies in psychology, discovered that one of the principal aspects of consciousness is a kind of rhythmic movement to which he assigned the Greek term enantiodromia, that we move along and then there seems to be a reversal. Now, this is a very interesting thing to observe, because if one studies the Theosophical philosophy, for example, one soon comes to one of the fundamental principles that is presented to the student in the Theosophical philosophy, and that is the principle of cyclical return, of cyclical movement, of rhythm. Rhythm, which leads on to the concept that is frequently spoken of in Theosophical philosophy of reincarnation, but that there is this rhythmic nature to all life. And consequently, in this transiency of the experience, there is a reversal, beautifully talked about by St. John of the Cross, one of the great Christian mystics, who used the term the dark night of the soul. A beautiful phrase, that one moves from this illumination, this utterly blinding illumination, into this other moment, the dark night of the soul, the travail, the cloud of unknowing descends, and so on. But that it is a momentariness. Now, perhaps this quality of transiency is best illustrated if one turns to the type of mysticism that is best exemplified in Zen Buddhism. We see it in a poem, a very interesting poem by the Zen pupil Chao Pien, who was a high government official in the Sung dynasty and who was a disciple of one of the great Zen masters. And Chao Pien describes the experience that overcame him, that he had been receiving a group of people as he was a government officer. He had been receiving these people, discussing affairs of state and so on. They left his office, they left his presence, and he sat there at his desk. And suddenly he wrote, or afterwards he wrote this: devoid of thought, I sat quietly by the desk in my official room, with my fountain mind undisturbed, as serene as water. A sudden clash of thunder, the mind doors burst open, and lo, there sitteth the old man in all his homeliness. A perception of a clash of thunder, the momentariness of it, and a new perception of himself, a new way. And so in Zen, which leads to the mystical experience, Satori, which is this illumination, this flash of insight, is said to come abruptly and is a momentary experience. And this is this quality of transiency. The fourth characteristic has been referred to by many terms and often as the quality of passivity, or even a quality or characteristic of voidness, a kind of inner emptiness, which is also paradoxically a fullness, a plenum. But the quality of passivity, in which there is a deep inner obedience and resignation, in which one lets go. And one of the aspect of this quality is the ceasing to strive, as it were, that one suddenly just is. And there is the experience. In the writings of the great Chinese mystic Lao Tzu, this is in the whole philosophy of Taoism, this is referred to as voidness. And I've always loved personally the example that Lao Tzu uses in his writings. 30 spokes will converge in the hub of the wheel, but the use of the cart will depend on the part of the hub that is void. With a wall all around, a clay bowl is molded, but the use of the bowl will depend on the part of the bowl that is void. So advantage is had from whatever is there, but usefulness arises from whatever is not. So it is this emptiness, this passivity, this utter, as it were, letting go. This could also be called an emptying of the self. And many Christian mystics have said that this is essential for the realization of that oneness which is the true mystical experience. So there is this characteristic that one lets go. One may have been striving. There are marvelous references to this kind of passivity. One of the great scientists has referred to this, Kekulé, in describing how he discovered the atomic structure of a particular element that he had been searching and searching and searching. He had been really, as a friend of mine always says, cracking his brain to try to discover what was this particular atomic structure. And he was riding on the top of a double-decker bus in London, one of those famous London omnibuses. And suddenly the manner in which he said he suddenly relaxed. He wasn't thinking about this at all. And the rhythm of the wheels turning on the pavement, over the stones in the pavement, suddenly began to beat out a pattern. And as it reached his consciousness in this state of relaxation, he could hardly get home fast enough to write down the formula for the atomic structure. A fascinating sort of thing. But it was because he had let go, he said. He had relaxed. He was no longer striving. And so there came this experience that led ultimately to his discovery. The fifth has been called the presence of a consciousness of the oneness of everything. And this, I think, is one of the great experiences and one of the great characteristics of the experience. This absolute awareness that everything is one. In one of the Upanishads, in Hindu mysticism, for example, there is nothing in this world that is not God. He is action, purity. Find him in the cavern, gnaw the knot of ignorance. Shining, yet hidden, spirit lives in the cavern. Everything that sways, breathes, opens, closes, lives in spirit. Beyond learning, beyond everything, better than anything, living, unliving. It is the undying, blazing spirit, that seed of all seeds, wherein lay hidden the world and all its creatures. It is life, speech, mind, reality, immortality. The Mundaka Upanishad. I'm trying to draw references, you'll see, from all of the great religious systems, philosophic systems, to indicate that these are universal experiences. One of the earliest of Sufi poets, Baba Kuhi, wrote of the vision of God in everything. In the market, in the cloister, only God I saw. In the valley and on the mountain, only God I saw. Him I have seen beside me oft in tribulation. In favor and in fortune, only God I saw. In prayer and fasting, in praise and contemplation, in the religion of the prophet, only God I saw. And he goes on great length, a long exposition. But every phrase, only God I saw, wherever I looked. This, of course, is the tremendous experience that is possible. This presence of a consciousness of the oneness of everything. That wherever one looks, whatever one sees, And there is a very interesting, I think it may be in Rainer Johnson, a description of someone who was looking at a garbage heap and suddenly realized that it was not only beautiful, but that the divine was present in that also. This presence of the one, everywhere one looks. One of the characteristics, and closely related to the characteristic of transiency, is the sense of timelessness, the fact that no time really exists. And I think one of the most fascinating examples of this is the experience that has been related by Warner Allen in his book, The Timeless Moment, when he describes a most vivid experience, a true mystic experience that came to him between two notes of a symphony. Now, this is really timelessness, isn't it? Between, as he says, it flashed up lightning-wise during a performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony at the Queen's Hall in the triumphant fast movement, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. The swiftly flowing continuity of the music was not interrupted, so that what T.S. Eliot calls the intersection of the timeless moment must have slipped in between two demi-semi-quavers. And yet a whole experience, and yet he didn't miss a bit of the symphony. As this kind of quality. And others have spoken of this timelessness that is present. One of the very interesting stories is that of John Buchan, who during a period of his life that he was in South Africa, went out before breakfast. John Buchan, who was Governor General of Canada, I believe, at one time, wasn't he? And a great mystery story writer in addition, and various other things. And in his autobiography, Memory Hold the Door, speaks of going out before breakfast, while breakfast was cooking. And then and there came on me the hour of revelation. Sense, sights, and sounds blended into a harmony so perfect that it transcended human expression, even human thought. And yet he goes on to say that it was just a momentary, it was timeless, and yet when he returned to consciousness, breakfast was still cooking. It hadn't even finished cooking yet. He hadn't burned anything, and so on, all of this. Of course, one of the great experiences of this timelessness, this expression of it, occurs in the great mystic writings of Meister Eckhart, one of the truly notable figures, of course, of Christian mysticism. As he wrote, "Time is fulfilled when time is no more. He who in time has his heart established in eternity, and in whom all temporal things are dead, in him is the fullness of time." And so he goes on that there is no time, that there is this, the now wherein God made the world is as near this time as the now I am speaking in this moment, and the last day is as near this now as was yesterday, the soul's day and God's day. This timelessness. Well, the seventh characteristic is bound up with the sense of oneness and a sense of timelessness, because it is the characteristic of the loss of the personal self, a conviction that the phenomenal ego is not the real I. This is often referred to as a melting away of one's own individuality into the infinite. And in the mystical literature of all the great traditions, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, one finds such phrases as fading away, passing away, melting. And in Islam, particularly in this great Sufi tradition of union through love, there is always this melting into becoming one with the beloved, and this kind of experience in which there is no longer a separate I. There is no longer I here and you there, this sort of thing. But there is a loss of the phenomenalistic self. Tennyson wrote, "All at once, as it were out of the intensity of the consciousness of individuality, individuality itself seemed to dissolve and fade away into boundless being. The loss of personality, if such it were, seeming no extinction, but the only true life." This complete loss of a sense of the individuality, of the I-ness, the phenomenalistic sort of gathering together of all the things that we think of as I, as myself, as here I am. This passing, this melting away of that. Well, in addition to these seven marked characteristics, and one could read many experiences, that there are some beautiful ones in many of the anthologies on mysticism. In addition to these seven characteristics of the experience itself, and I think the only way we can really define the mystical experience or try to describe the nature of the mystical experience is by suggesting these marks, these characteristics. There is one further aspect that I think should be noted, although we will discuss it far more in detail next week when we discuss the distinction, if there is such, at least try to look at the mystical experience and what has been called the psychic or the parapsychological experience. And that is the value of the experience, that is the value element within the experience, its significance. It's been called the point of creative renewal. What happens to one as a result of the experience? Are we transformed by the experience? All of the great mystics, and in fact, everyone who has written on mysticism or tried to define the experience, Buck's book, Cosmic Consciousness, again and again, this kind of experience leads to a transformation of the personal self. One somehow sees things differently. One acts differently. Perhaps the most notable case in our own tradition is the experience of Saul on the road to Damascus and this sudden conversion, and even to the point of being renamed, because one is no longer the same. So one does have a new name. A new name is taken because one is a new person. And now, as Paul knows, participates directly in a knowing of all that before then he had struggled with, had wanted to know, had been frustrated about, had despaired over, couldn't understand, and so on. The most dramatic conversion in our own Western tradition. Well, as I say, this will be an essential consideration when we come to consider the subject next week of mysticism and parapsychology. But I wanted to bring it in here because while it is not technically part of the experience, it is one of the characteristics that it seems to me distinguishes this kind of experience is its effect. What happens to us? Among writers, there seems to be, at times, a conflicting view as to what produces the mystical experience, and I'd like to comment on this just briefly before I throw it open for our discussion. This, I think, is perhaps one of the points that is most frequently sort of discussed. I was going to say debated, but that's a wrong term. But it is discussed by various writers. Some suggest, for example, that no one chooses to be a mystic of his own volition, that the individual simply undergoes some sort of experience which is of sufficient intensity to lead to an expansion of his normal consciousness. And so there comes to him a new vision of reality which dominates his life and thought. In other words, he experiences a conversion, but not of his own volition. Now, other writers, many in all of the great traditions, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, all of the great traditions, many writers suggest that there must be a preparation for the mystical experience, that the genuine mystical experience begins with a definite preparation of the individual. Begins with a state or attitude of inner resignation to a higher source, an interior realization of reality, an obedience to something beyond the personal self, followed by a purification of the senses, and so on. And there are various steps on the way. There is the mystic ladder to be climbed of Eckhart, very similar to Jacob's ladder in the Bible, this kind of thing. There is the devotions of Ignatius of Loyola. All of these that are steps along the way. In Buddhist meditation, Buddhist mysticism, there are definite steps along the way to be taken. As I suggested last week, one can simplify it into three major steps, three major stages of the mystic experience: the way of purgation or purification, the way of contemplation, the way of union or illumination. But others, as I say, this is the wide area where you will find this kind of difference of view, that the mystic experience comes totally uninvited, not of one's own volition, and the other is that one can take the steps. In Hinduism, it is suggested that yoga, for example, is the philosophy that leads to this union with reality, which is the goal of the mystical experience. Well, so you can take your choice. You can make the determination whether one prepares oneself, whether one can take certain steps, or whether it's just a kind of happenstance experience. But I'd like to leave it at this point and